This is part of a series I've created that is part of our lineage, our ray called Zarat, which Hazard and I started. And Sam Lewis, of course, who we're here particularly to celebrate this week, was also a farmer, a gardener. And this Zarat lineage, this ray, has been a little inaccessible. It was the last part of Hazard and I at Khan's teachings, and he really didn't fully develop it. And I'm working myself to develop something that's more accessible, and I'm calling it the Garden Path. And the subtitle is How Shall We Live? How shall we create a community, a culture of awakening? And so I've got the steps of gardening, and the last step for me is the celebration and the fruition. And since it's gardening, that is has to do with gardening and eating. So I'm calling this section the sacrament. It's about food as spiritual gift rather than product. So this is from one of the Upanishads. Bhrigu went to his father Varuna, that's the god of the oceans, and asked respectfully, "What is Brahman?" Varuna replied, "First learn about food, breath, eye, ear, speech, and mind. Then seek to know that from which these are born, by which they live, for which they search, and to which they return. That is Brahman." Bhrigu meditated and found that food is Brahman. From food are born all creatures, by food they grow, and to food they return. So I got the idea from this, from Paul Shepherd's Nature and Madness, written in 1982. Beneath the veneer of civilization lies not a barbarian, an animal, but the human in us who knows the rightness of receiving food as a spiritual gift rather than as a product. Thomas Berry says it is through food we connect with nature and understand interdependence. And Mary McGillis, who is the director of Genesis Farm and part of the Green Sister Movement, you've heard this, that the monks make the vows and the sisters keep them. Well, there's a very strong movement now of sisters who are returning to the values of the early Benedictine monks and living that way. And she writes, "If we understand the earth as a living being whose activities are to nourish, govern, learn, heal, regenerate, and transform itself," she's describing the Gaia theory, that this is a living being, organism, our earth. "If we understand the earth as a living being whose activities are to nourish, govern, learn, heal, regenerate, and transform itself, then the mystery at the heart of human existence opens up and draws us into the sacramental aspect of our lives through the most ordinary and familiar way, through eating and growing our food." I think Sam would agree with that. He not only did the gardening, and he got his myriads into the garden, and at another time Shabda can tell us many stories, and he made a big deal out of feeding his myriads. So I think that this is on his track. "When we open to the contemplation of food as the holy mystery through which we eat ourselves into existence, then the meaning of existence reveals itself. Food isn't a metaphor for spiritual nourishment. It is itself spiritual. We are nourished by the divine directly. So, spirituality isn't standing still. The truths may be eternal, but those of us who are trying to articulate and disseminate awareness and light, I think that we have to stay current with the gestalt, with what's happening now. And in this way, we have to kind of keep up. We can't only just repeat ancient truths. So this is from another sister, Green Sister, in that network, articulating the philosophy of biocentrism, which has become part of the deep ecology movement, and of course differs completely from what the church promotes as humans as the crown of creation. I no longer believe in the old cosmology I had been taught, the hierarchical pyramid of creation, in which human animals near the top of the pyramid are assigned more worth than non-human animals and other beings toward the bottom. I am beginning to accept a new worldview in which all creation has inherent worth and beauty, a moral order in which all created beings are moving to a stage of harmony, equality, and respect for each other. I no longer believe that non-humans are inferior to humans in God's scheme of creation. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide. Another split, detrimental, is this elevating the spirit and denigrating the material. Llewellyn von Lee is a Sufi who has chosen to speak about these issues, says, "We can't dismiss the earth in favor of the light. Wherever I turn is Allah." That's from the Quran. God is immanent. And I feel this is the most important thing that we can teach at this time, that God is everywhere through all of creation, and that we know God here, now, through everything. The Buddha, after he became aware of disease and sickness, aging, left his palace garden and joined the ascetics of the time and did their traditional practices. He wanted to understand what life, and he did that for years with them. And they were doing the typical practices of those days, which was what the Christians would call mortification of the body. Christians have done this too. He did this until he was nearly a skeleton. And then I think he did it for 7 years. And then, this is what is said. I don't know if any of this is true, but this is what we like to believe about the Buddha. Then he said, suffering is not created in the body. It's created in the mind. So he left the ascetics, and they were throwing peaches or nectarines at him and calling him a wuss and a cop-out. What did Carrie say? He should man up and stay with them. The first person he saw was Sujata, who was a milkmaiden. And she gave him a bowl of rice milk gruel, warm rice milk gruel. And he drank that down, and he was flooded with realization, with gratitude, with understanding of the connectedness It was his beginning insight into interdependence, which later, much later in his teaching, he would be heard to say, when did I ever say consciousness is independent of the base of consciousness? We know this all through our body. It's in the Upanishads. What you cannot understand in your own body, you can understand nowhere else. In spite of all the farmer's work and worry, he cannot reach down to where the seed is slowly transmuted into summer. The earth bestows. That's from Rilke. So McGillis says, the soils have been exhausted and drugged, their inner life forces depleted and poisoned. Not because we are necessarily an evil species, so much as that we are driven by our abstract ideas about a perfect world. We have been acculturated toward an inability to experience the universe as it actually is. We end up tearing apart the garden planet in our efforts to redesign it. If we were to accept the Earth on the terms and under the exquisite conditions in which it continues to evolve, the role of the farmer would be raised to the most honorable and sacred human profession. Relieved of the illusion that they are manufacturing food or that they are worthy of success to the degree that they are also economists, cosmeticists, and managers, farmers might understand themselves as acting something akin to a prophetic and priestly role. We need to see the farmers and gardeners as entering the sanctuary of the soil and engaging the mysterious forces of creation in order to bless and nourish the inner and outer life of the community they serve. We live in a universe with an inner spiritual reality. There is nothing that does not participate in the deep sacramental presence, the soils, the microbes, the animals, all are revelatory. And that's what Hazar Nayak Khan said. There's one holy book, the sacred manuscript of nature, the only scripture that can enlighten the reader. And Thomas Berry said the same thing, the universe is the only text without a context. McGillis says if we understand the universe in this way, it has the capacity to transform our obsession with control and power. And let's hope so. Mm-hmm. Amen. Say? Well, just simply to understand the universe this way would help us with our impulses for control and power. Soil for legs, axe for hands, flowers for eyes, bird for ears, mushroom for nose, songs for lungs, smile for mouth, sweat for skin, wind for mind. Just enough. That's Namo Sakaki. So if you were to go to Africa, if you were lucky enough, you would probably see at some time, if you were doing the safari thing, a lioness with her cubs playing around her. They've just taken down a gazelle. They've just devoured it. She has blood dripping down her chin, and they do too. Everybody, they're all fully fed. And all around them, the whole herd will just be grazing around that. Do you know why?
The line's full.
They're not afraid.
Just enough. Mm-hmm. The lion's had enough. At what safer place can there be? Mm-hmm. They're in her protection. No other lion's going to attack because she's right there. So it's the safest place they can be. Now, they aren't going to stay there when, you know, after a day or two, they're going to know to move on. But she knows she'll just have enough. And that seems to be like a gene that is somehow, we're losing touch with that in our culture. That the satisfaction gene, the satisfactoriness gene. So our spiritual practice is, we're hoping that we're developing a kind of faith and trust that the universe is providing for us what we need, that everything we really need is flowing our way. And the abundance of the universe, Yah, Kareem. And I learned a quote from Shanta last year here, Rumi. For many years I've searched and been discontent, but never for an instant has this flowing toward me ever stopped. So we could do that practice, Yah Kareem, right now, that was Eva. But I would instead would like to teach you another practice tonight. It's from the Buddhist tradition, and it's called mindful eating. This is from Michael Pollan. To eat slowly means to eat deliberately with freedom from compulsion. Many food cultures, particularly those at less of a remove from the land than ours, have rituals to encourage that sort of eating, such as offering a grace or a blessing. The point is to make sure that we don't eat thoughtlessly or hurriedly, and that knowledge and gratitude will infuse our pleasure at the table. Now, I know that this idea of a blessing at the table, a lot of people may have had that when they were young, and been kind of turned off by it. We cannot force gratitude. Gratitude cannot be called up. Gratitude is something you feel in response. It's a responsive emotion. It's true when we sing the graces. For instance, I didn't have to do grace when I was growing up. And when I went to friends' houses where they did, I couldn't really feel it. But I do feel it when we sing it. Because the singing brings in that gratitude because we're filling ourselves with that beauty, that song. But also, what I'd like to teach tonight is just the pure enjoyment of eating, so that we can be flooded with gratitude for this sacrament. Mm-hmm. Michael Pollan says, eating with the fullest pleasure, pleasure that is, that does not depend on ignorance, is perhaps the profoundest enactment of our connection with the world. In this pleasure, we experience and celebrate our dependence and our gratitude, for we are living from the mystery, from creatures we did not make, and powers we cannot comprehend. So how about a practice that encourages us to do what we already love to do the best? And that's eating mindfully. It's a practice just inviting us to indulge in our natural aesthetic response to life, to enjoy this gift that's being given to us from the earth. Now, this mindfulness practice, if we begin with this, something we love to do, can expand to all facets of our life, of course. We want to feel the aesthetic pleasure in everything we do, in our movements, in not just our songs here, but when we're speaking, in our voices, in the faces, we want to feel that aesthetic response, the pleasure of living more and more. I believe that's our salvation. Mm-hmm. So, but we'll start with the perfunctory raisin that's become the habit of in Vipassana courses when we teach meditation. So that's going to be our dessert tonight. I'm going to pass out a raisin for each of you. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you to take the raisin and don't eat it yet. We'll all do it at the same time. And just begin, when you receive the raisin, to begin to come into this body where we know, where consciousness meets our experience. So to feel the raisin and so forth. Don't eat them yet, but you can touch and smell and relate. Many of you have heard me say this. I heard it from Jack Kornfield years ago. Mindfulness is like the sign in Las Vegas, you must be present to win. And so mindfulness, being present, it takes two things. It takes concentration, and it takes place in time. Experience actually takes place in time. So to do anything mindfully, we have to have concentration, and we have to be... Shabda's talking all the time about being in rhythm with life's conditions. We have to be in rhythm with everything we're doing, with our actions, with our movements. So we have to be in rhythm with this process of eating. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, if he's doing the dishes and he isn't feeling the warmth of the water on his hands, but he's thinking about the cup of tea he's going to have afterwards, he says, life isn't even worth living. It's not being lived, in fact. If we're not there for that moment, it's one of the moments in our lives that we missed. The only moments in our lives that we're there for are the ones that we're there for. And that's taking place with presence, with bringing our attention to where we are now. So that is what we're going to try and do with this grape, this raisin. So simply, I'm asking that... when you put it in your mouth, first to feel it with your tongue for a while, and then take one chomp and no more, and then just feel what that taste, what that brings, what is wrought forth, and then another chomp and what is brought forth. And then do those chomps mindfully and slowly so that you can actually notice when there is an explosion of taste, and so forth. So I won't belabor this too long, but take a minute or two to eat this raisin, if you will. And it's a, you know, it's an inside job, so you can keep your eyes down like you would if you were meditating. It's definitely your own experience. It's your own direct experience. Usually, often when we're eating, we want what we already have in our mouth. I mean, the fork is already down for the next bite, but we have a bite of food in our mouths. And that, I use that also to describe our thirst for any kind of experiences, for our own spiritual thirst. We want what we already are. It's always just about coming in now to what is here. And food is like that too. When we're eating, we can practice that. We can practice actually enjoying this bite instead of thinking about the next one. Because I think this driven materialism in our culture is it's the very same thing. Nobody's enjoying themselves because they're so busy wanting. Asha mentioned that today, the desiring body, that people snap into the desiring body, they forget to just appreciate now.
The world needs our joy.
The joy comes from feeling satisfied. Mm. The peace comes from feeling satisfied, and so we owe it to ourselves to become satisfied so that we can be the real peacemakers. As I said, if we eat mindfully, because we love to eat, it's an easy thing to be mindful of. It will help us expand our capacity to be mindful of everything. And it gives our life. We're making sacred this act, and we're honoring the food, our own bodies, the people, the animals, the plants that have brought us the food. It really, I think it brings dignity to our lives, to bring dignity to our eating.